The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
5 on 551 or Ray at RTE.ie. Now, Les Miserables is running in on Bord Gáis Energy Theatre at the moment, or even the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. And that is a Cameron McIntosh production. And sitting in front of me is Cameron McIntosh. You know, when I first heard Cameron McIntosh, I thought it was two people together.
What a disappointment. Yes, you end up with me. Yeah. How awful.
Did you feel from an early age you had to live up to your name? Because it is quite an impressive name, isn't it?
I originally tried to change my name to, like, Cameron Mitchell, and then I realised that there was an actor called Cameron Mitchell. I thought, no one's going to remember my name. And I did try. I can't remember. I went through a few names. And in the end, all the names that I thought I'd like, someone else had. And I went, oh, well, it'll have to be Cameron McIntosh. Yeah. But, of course, in hindsight, it's quite useful to have a difficult name, because once people bother to remember it...
They have it for life.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, like you, they have it for life.
They have me.
And you were nicknamed in secondary school. Were you in boarding school because you were always putting on plays... It was sort of producer name, something F, something.
You've done some interesting research. I'm very frightened now about what you might have discovered about me. I was named after a famous American film producer called Daryl F. Zanuck.
Right.
So I was known as Daryl F. McIntosh at school. Well, when I did the annual great concerts.
Yeah.
I went to a minor public school run by the Christian Brothers in Bath.
It is an odd, you know, when Auntie comes around and says, little Cameron, what do you want to be when you grow up, little Cameron? And you always wanted to be.
Yes, and it wasn't my aunt. I told my auntie that's what I was going to be. Thanks to my aunties that who brought me up when my parents came back from Italy after the war and had to live in my grandmother's house, that they loved the theatre, and they took me at a very young age, about 6 or 7, and a show that opened in London when I was 7 was called Salad Days, about a magic piano that made all London dance. It became the huge hit and ran for over 5.5 years. So I was taken to see it and I didn't want to go, and then I was of course entranced. So they said, on my 8th birthday, what would I like to see again? And I went, I want to see Salad Days again. So that day I did actually dress up in my finest kilt and march down the aisle at the end of the show, where I had realised by that time that the composer of Salad Days, Julian Slade, was playing the pit in the playing the piano in the pit.
Yeah.
And at the end of the show, he was really nice to me and said, would I like to come backstage? And he showed me how Minnie the Magic Piano was mimed on stage by the actors and how he played it and how the flying saucer came in and how the scenery went in and out. And I went, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up. And within a few weeks, I found out that the role that I wanted was the role of a producer.
It's fascinating, isn't it? To know so young.
It is. And a year later, another relative said, oh, I was listening to a program about what you're going to do in your future. And I said, what was it? It was on the radio. They said, so it was a program called The Impresarios. And I went, I don't want to be an impresario. Impresarios put on other shows belonging to other people. I want to put on my own shows.
And that's what's different about you. So Impresarios is sort of... Yeah. But Impresarios is you would look down your nose at...
No, it isn't. It's a different skill.
Yeah.
No, I like
creating
things.
How do you describe your skill then?
I just interfere in everything. And, I don't know. I've always loved musicals, but I have done a lot of plays as well, because I had to teach myself about, you know, storytelling. And for me, when I'm trying to fall in love with a project, I have to love the story first and then the characters and then the music. The music has to be theatrical music that supports the storytelling. So even though I thoroughly enjoy compilation shows, if they're well done, or musical comedies, nearly all the shows that I do are based on great classic books. Not on purpose, I hasten to add. It's funny, going back over my career, I realised that nearly everything I've done has come back from a classic source material.
So it has to be a brilliant story first.
A brilliant story or brilliant writing. Yeah. Something
like
completely...
T.S. Eliot,
P.L. Travers, Herman Melville with Moby Dick.
It didn't, but it was
fun. Yeah. Riot is fun and still gets done. It was madcap. But, you know, Dickens
Oliver,
you know,
done. Yeah.
Kipling and, obviously Hugo with Les Miserables. I mean, everything I've done. I mean, even the odd compilation show, which is sort of like Side by Side by Sondheim, which is one of the first international hit, was based on the work of Stephen Sondheim. It was the words. When I did Tomfoolery, which is a show, another show I co-wrote and put together, the works of the great Tom Lehrer. That's what attracts me. Louis Jordan, you know, with Five Guys Named Mo. It was the world according to Louis Jordan.
Yeah.
So there's always some element of the writing that is the cohesive reason I want to do this.
Side by Side was a big success, your first big success.
Yes.
And what I didn't know, and I thought I'd done all my research, there's a Gay Byrne connection.
Ah, Gay Byrne. He was played the great Ned Sherrin. He came when we did it on an island. I think it was the Gaiety we did it at. And Gay took over the role that Ned Sherrin played in London with the original cast. And he was wonderful. He was great fun. It was a perfect role for him.
Yes.
Wickedly naughty and wry. And very funny.
His enunciation is perfect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I love working with him on that.
Yeah. I'm looking at you now. You don't look your age at all. No, you look amazing for man of your age.
Nice. But even in this light. Even in this terrible light.
Yeah. But obviously, you know that thing, you're a classic example of find something you love and get somebody to pay you for it, and then you'll be a happy man.
Absolutely. I mean, I could never, ever have imagined, A, that I would end up being as successful as I've been, and B, that actually people would still want to come and see my shows in all these decades later.
Which is the longest running of the shows?
Well, the longest running by a year is Les Mis, you know, which is now just in London gone into its 34th year and still playing to 95% capacity is indeed, and this new production which is opening tonight here is, you know, a fantastic success, and the biggest sellout I've ever had in Dublin of all my shows. It's the one that sold out far in advance. So sadly, your viewers, if you haven't, your listeners, if you haven't got tickets, you have to wait until we come back next time. But you know that, and of course, Phantom of the Opera has been a colossal success, and indeed has Cats, which still carries on with Cats. The difference is Cats. I haven't reinvented Cats in the same way as I've reinvented Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera and Miss Saigon and Oliver.
When do you know? When do you realise something needs a reinvention?
Well, it's not always my decision, but where it is my decision, I find that after 25 years running, which most shows don't have the privilege of running, I get restless.
Oh, yeah,
I can't.
Yeah.
I want to reinvent it with a new generation, because normally with a show, you know, after five or ten years, they would have ended its run. Someone else would have come up with a new version. But these shows are now in their fourth decade. It's just absolutely extraordinary. So for their 25th anniversary of all of them, I found a new creative team that does new scenery and new direction, and I do them all over again.
And you know those shows better than anybody.
I do, and therefore it's not as hard. It's hard in one way, in that of course you have an incredibly high benchmark to achieve, but at the same time you also know inside you, if that works, you don't change it just for the sake of change. You do it because you've got an idea that works as well, if not better. So I am actually, I've got a metronome of quality beating inside me that insists that when I do it again, it's absolutely, it's full of more surprises.
So you've seen Cats and Les Miserables and Phantom of the Opera countless times, I would imagine.
Oh, indeed.
And you have a favourite, do you have a favourite moment, or does that shift?
No, I mean, for me, the thing that changes every time is that when you get in a new production, you get a new artist that brings a different nuance to material that's incredibly familiar to you, and you see it working in a way that you couldn't imagine ever being better. That you go, how amazing that to be, as I say, part of an artistic process that allows whole new talent take something that everybody thinks they know and make it refashioned brand new.
Tell me about your first meeting with Andrew Lloyd Webber. What age were you and what age was he?
I was probably about mid-30s. Andrew's 18 months younger than me, so
I'd say he reminds you about that, does he?
What?
Does your
Well, now he's 70.
Yes.
Now he's in his 70s now. He's got the bus pass. We can travel around London for free now. See, so, well, the first proper meeting I had with him was at the Savile Club, where we sort of decided that we needed to have lunch with each other. We'd only passed each other at the odd parties. And we had an incredible boozy lunch and went back home to his house. And that was when he said he had this idea, which I knew by then everyone else had turned down, which was for setting T.S. Eliot's poems to music. And he said, played me 8 or 9 of them, and I went, "Ooh, I really like those." And he said, "So do you think, what do you think?" I said, "I don't know, but there's something there. Let's try and do it." And we thought it would be, at first, we thought it would be one half of a double bill, like a dance double bill, and we would do them like a modern facade with dancers and someone singing the songs. Anyway, after about 3 or 4 months, we both trying to get people to involved, and nobody was interested, and so...
Andrew Why? Said, because it sounded so daft.
Everyone turned it down. So it was the most stupid idea that they'd ever heard of. And anyway, I think Trevor Nunn, who I did say to Andrew, Trevor Nunn was running the RSC, you know, absolutely the height of its powers. His powers on the RSC was doing fantastic work at that point. And I said, "Go and meet, because I think if this is going to come onto the stage, Trevor is the right person to do it." Working with the great late Gillian Lynn, who I knew very well, and I'd done several shows with.
She was a choreographer.
And she was a great choreographer. Yeah. The pair of them might bring this oddball idea to life. And even Trevor said rather lugubriously, "It was wonderful meeting Andrew, but what a shame he presented me with the only bad idea he's ever had." But of course, 6 months later, Trevor got intrigued and, you know, was absolutely a major architect of why Cats.
And did he call Rice memory?
He did. I mean, there was Tim Rice wrote a version of it as well, particularly when Elaine stepped in after poor
Judy Dench.
This was Elaine Page, after Judy Dench had snapped her Achilles tendon, because she was the first person to be cast for the show for Grisabella, but sadly she couldn't do it. And Elaine, you know, had this wonderful success in it. And of course, Tim and Elaine knew each other very well at that point. And Tim wrote a lyric, but in the end, Trevor had been working at adapting a lot of Eliot into the song of the same title, Memory. And, you know, a decision had to be made, and indeed, probably Trevor's version was more Eliot-esque, as they say. Though
you're choosing your words carefully.
The first preview was Tim Rice's version, and the second preview was hers. And I remember turning to the usherette saying, "So, tell me, what did you think of it? Did you like the song?" And she said, "Oh, I loved it tonight." And this was the first night of Trevor's lyric, and she said, "But I loved it last night." She didn't think she noticed the difference.
So what is it that drives you when people are saying this is a daft idea, you know, and you know, the doors are shutting in your face? What drives you on? What's inside you?
To me, you know, if I'm intrigued by the idea of a story or the music, for a project, you know, I go, this is theatrical, this is telling a story in a different way, which is exactly what happened with Les Miserables, using almost the same words you've used. They went, director came to me with the original concept album of Les Mis in French, which was done in a sort of stadium in 1980, and said anyone mad enough to have done Cats might think of doing Victor Hugo's Tomb. And of course, when I listened to it a few days later, I was blown away and thought, wow, this is extraordinary, and I really want to do it. And I tracked down Alain Boubile and Claude-Michel Schoenberg, the original French authors in France, and said to them, what I wanted to do was rebuild the show as a proper musical, because what they'd originally done in France, the French understood, because they know the book
story,
backwards.
Yeah.
And therefore, you could just refer and everyone knew what they were talking about. But I need to people like me, who only had the vague idea of what the story was about, to rebuild it as a proper musical. But it is the material. It is the material that...
always come back to that.
Always, it's always... It's the, as Verdi said, what is the secret to a great opera? The book, the book, the book. And that's why Puccini and Verdi were absolutely vociferous in finding the best lyricists and book writers of their time. And why their operas are still the ones that keep opera houses going around the world.
We have to take a quick commercial break. We're speaking to Cameron McIntosh, and we'll continue our chat after this.
Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. 51551, we're speaking to Cameron McIntosh. He's not an impresario, he's a musical theatre producer.
And theatre owner now.
And theatre owner. Eight theatres.
Eight theatres in London, which I've loved rebuilding. And the most recent one, which nearly killed me, was redoing the Victoria Palace in London. But the irony was, because I bought it, because knowing that I could actually extend the stage in the future, and therefore end, because there's always been a beautiful theatre, though run down, but it had a very limited stage, and I had the chance to add 20 feet to the stage in the whole rebuilding of the Victoria area. But so, as I said, the big irony in it is that Hamilton didn't require the new stage. All right. So I've actually got the original stage. Though luckily I've got a show that is actually going to contribute mightily to me actually being able to afford to pay for it.
Right. You know. So Hamilton, will you explain the success of Hamilton?
Well, nobody can explain the success of any hit musical.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, the thing is, Lin-Manuel Miranda was put on earth to write this phenomenal musical. I mean, no one else in their right mind.
Yeah,
I totally believe it. You know, because no one else would have, in their right mind, picking up this book, this very successful book, which was about Alexander Hamilton, who, you know, was the treasurer who set up the entire American financial system that we still use today, that as one of the founding fathers of America, how would that possibly make him a musical? And he was inspired because his father was a political fixer in Washington. So he, as a boy, had been upstairs whilst all the politicians downstairs were making their deals and doing this and that. So it suddenly he went, what? I understand who these people are. Nothing has changed since the founding of America. And as we're seeing today, the machinations of politicians know no bounds. So, you know, the idea of what this story can be has made it completely timeless. You don't have, when I went to see it in America, I mean, the first question they asked me was, would us Brits get it? And I would go, well, why wouldn't we? We see this in different guises all the time. Mm. And it's a fascinating story and it has wonderful human emotions. Of course it will work.
I suppose hip-hop in a musical makes sense because you can tell the story better than a song.
Hugely. And, you know, I went... when I went to America hearing about the hip-hop, and I went...
What you
well,
think?
As I wrote, I'll hop on a plane, but I wonder if I'm hip enough to understand what it is when I get there, because I'm not on the cutting edge of music, you know, because by the time you get a musical score done, the new fashions have gone.
You've moved on,
but what it brilliantly does is underline the story, and it's a way of getting a huge amount of information done fast. But actually, two-thirds of the score... maybe more, are just great, great songs, which are the heart, you know, the backbone of any great musical.
What about, I don't know what you call them, I don't know what the name for them is, but like Mamma Mia and We Will Rock You and those, you know, musicals with extant songs that are there already. What do you call them? Is there a
The generic name, which I haven't come up with, is Jukebox Musicals.
Oh, Jukebox Musicals, right. What do you think of those?
There are a couple I've had been involved in, which, not that I've done them myself, but, you know, obviously Mamma Mia was the first great big one. And it's a terrific piece. You know, the book is very clever. And funny enough, I was involved with the origination of that, which came from Alan Bubiel, who wrote Les
Miserables,
because he had an original concept as the publisher of ABBA in France of doing a thing called Abacadabra.
Right.
And I staged Abacadabra in London.
So that was the precursor to Mamma Mia.
Yes, with Anthony Van Last choreographing it, and Judy Kramer, who was a very old childhood friend, also working on the show. And she, at the end of the run, I had a big starry cast with Elaine Page in it. You know, it was great success, but I didn't know what to do with it. And she said, look, could she sort of run with the idea? And few years later, she came back with a completely different idea, but utilising ABBA's music, and which was a far better idea. And I am very grateful as a theatre owner that I've had a far greater success with Judy Kramer's Mamma Mia than I ever had with Abracadabra in all my theatres.
Because I get confused. Typically, does the musical come first and then the movie, or is it the other way around, or is there a mix of both?
Usually, I mean, well, it depends if you're doing a stage version of a musical, movie, like Singing the Rain recently in America and in London, was a stage version of the movie.
Yeah.
But with most famous musicals, the musical comes first.
Yes, that would Les Mis, and you were a producer on that.
Yes.
And you have the rights for Mary Poppins now.
Well,
you
have
Mary Poppins. Who owns Mary Poppins.
No, I'm not. I got to know Pamela Travers when she was 93.
Right.
And Pamela had always been rather reticent about the original movie.
She was protective.
Mary Poppins, very protective. And for some reason said she didn't like the original songs. And I said to her when I met her, I want to do an adaptation of all your books for the stage version, not just the Disney movie. But I said, the reason I knew you were a writer was because when I was in 1964, when the film came out, I saw Mary Poppins, thought it was a wonderful film, and then noticed that you had written all the books. And I've loved those books. So eventually I persuaded her. I said, look, I'm not interested in doing it unless I can, you have your permission in the contract to go and approach Disney to see if they would work with me to give me what I felt were the essential key songs from the film. And it took a long time, just as Walt Disney took, I think, 15 years to persuade her to make the movie.
Originally, yes.
Originally, it took me another 10.
Did it?
Yes. Probably another 8 years to get Disney to agree to do that.
So is that 8 plus 15, 23, or is it
I'm saying it was. It took me
eight years. Yeah.
So I had originally tried to get the rights in 1977. So that my journey was very long to try and get the stage rights.
So next year the movies are and then the stage show is next year.
Yes, because we had, was it about 2 years ago, 18 months, 2 years ago, I brought my new version of Mary Poppins here, which was a phenomenal success, and it toured all around the country, and I've been waiting to bring it back into London. So the perfect timing now for Disney and I is that we've got the new film coming out in a couple of weeks, and we will be bringing back to London the original stage show, but redone in next October.
Where do you get your energy?
From my mother.
Right. Is your mother still alive?
My mother is about to celebrate an unmentionable birthday, but
100.
A very big one. I never said that, and you better not in front of my mother or she'll murder
you. She won't be listening.
No, she's in the south of France at the moment. It was a toss-up between here or the south of France, and she looked at the weather and said she's going to go to south
she
of France.
She made a good choice.
She's coming here because my nephew is actually playing Gavroche.
Is he in
the production tonight? Yes.
Oh, that's great.
So she wants to come and see him, quite rightly.
It's a family affair.
Yes.
Because she was your secretary at one stage, back in the...
That was a nightmare. But she was wonderful. My mother is
extraordinary.
She is. She was fronting a rock band in Marrakesh 6 weeks ago on the stage. And she still pole dances.
Does she?
Yes. Yes.
There you go. So it means that you've another 20 years here.
I've got a bit,
30 years,
bit more
30,
time.
30
I've got
years.
A bit more time.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you're still as energetic about it, still as enthusiastic.
I am. But it's, you know, it's working. I'm so lucky to have worked on so many literal classics, and also none of my shows really depend on stars. It's the material that's
the star,
and therefore I'm every new generation I can find new star performances, and that's what keeps me young and keeps my attention.
Will you tell me the story about how you met your partner, because it's a lovely romantic story.
Michael. Well, one of my early successes, which I did, I've done it twice now. One was an Australian actor, was of Oklahoma. I did a tour in the late 70s out here that went into London, was a great big success with John Deirdrick, who was a well-known Australian actor. And it was such a success that it went back to Australia, and I was asked if I would allow the rights to go there. So on the opening night of this show in Adelaide... Michael came into a room with someone else who I knew I was working with, and I looked across the room and went, there is somebody I'd like to meet. And we met that night, and we've been with each other 36 years since.
But the story about the airport.
Oh, the airport. Yes. Oh, well, that was... Well, you don't get anything nothing for free in life.
Right.
No, well, what it was, I heard he was going to... Michael was going back
You're
to
You're blushing
Sydney.
Now.
I am blushing. I am blushing. It goes nice with the blue. But was the airport the following day, I thought, I'm going to spend a bit of time with Michael. So I got to the airport knowing that he was going to travel back to Sydney the same day as me. But the trouble is, I didn't know A, the airline, and there were two airlines to go from Adelaide to Sydney, and I didn't know what time. So I got there thinking, we had a party last night. He can't possibly get there before 10 o'clock in the morning. And I stayed at the newsstand from 10 o'clock till 4 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock, he came back after a boozy lunch. And I went, oh, hello, Michael. What a surprise seeing you. Are you on the next flight? And he went, yes, I'm on this so-and-so. I said, oh, so am I. What a coincidence. And I rushed off to get a ticket. And we lived happily ever after.
Producing your own life very, very successfully.
Exactly. No, God produces that. God's the best producer of all, I can tell you that.
Yeah. So, Hugh Jackman, the greatest show...
greatest showman.
Yes.
And that, greatest human being.
Is he?
He's absolutely as great a guy as you think he's going to be. He's marvellous, smart, brilliantly talented.
Isn't he brilliant for the genre, for musicals?
He's a very good actor, yeah. but there's something about his ability to act through music, which very, very few people have it to the measure that he has.
And will that be a show eventually, or is it in the production already?
I hear that they will do a show at one point. But, of course, the only problem is that you're going to want to see Hugh Jackman in it, and I don't think he'll do it on the stage. I doubt if he would do it on the stage for very long, having had such a great success.
He's touring himself with the songs.
He is, absolutely. And looking, he's doing lots of stuff from Les Mis and from The Greatest Showman. So, anyway...
Right.
He was great, and he was so wonderful in Oklahoma because he was the second curly I had when he did it before.
What
he
year
went
was that?
America.
So that was before he was on his way up. Yeah, before he was famous.
It was just on the cusp, and the irony is, because it was the Trevor Nunn production, is that we could not take him to Broadway in it. Because American equity said, not only isn't he a star, but he's Australian.
Right, it's not going to work. And this is Oklahoma, is theirs.
They'd be protective about it. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think they lopped a few years off the show's run because they didn't have Hugh Jackman.
In it, yeah. Okay, just before I let you go, quick ones. Your favourite song from the musicals, or do you have one? What's your favourite song?
Oh... No, do I? I don't have a favourite one.
Okay,
favorite
your party
one.
Piece. Do you ever get up and sing a song?
No, never.
And I know you're heavy into cooking. So how do you do your roast potatoes for Christmas Day?
My roast potatoes. I do a parboil.
Yes, go on.
Parboil goose fat.
Yes,
very hot. Get the goose fat hot. Little seasoning and a few little herbs in it, and then into the oven, really crisp. Really crisp. For about an hour and a half, I have them. But I know because I try not to cook them too quick.
Right, right. Nigella Lawson puts semolina on them.
Does she?
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
It's not bad. I use the coarse semolina with a lot. I love it on fish.
Oh, do you?
Little
yes.
Little bit of fish, I do it with a little bit of chicken. It's very good just to give a little bit of grit and crunch to all sorts of stuff.
Now, Les Miserables is in Borgosh Entertainment Theatre. I don't know why I'm telling you because it's sold out, but it will return
it's
at
sad.
Some stage. Yes,
I hope we will bring it back.
And Borgosh Entertainment Theatre is a lovely theatre.
It's a fantastic theatre, and it's like coming home.
Yeah. Cameron,
maybe bring him home would be a very good way to end.
From the musical. Thanks, Cameron.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.